You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Coal-fired plants, transportation, and deforestation are usually cited as the main culprits in our increasing collective carbon footprint. But did you know that the food we eat is one of the largest contributors to climate change? The good news is that altering the ways we produce and distribute food can be good for our health and good for the planet. Tomorrow at New York University, the Manhattan Borough President, Scott Stringer, and the organization Just Food will host the Food and Climate Summit to discuss this pressing issue. And joining us now are Scott Stringer and two of the event's guest speakers, Marion Nessel, the Paulette Goddard Professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at NYU, and Anna LaPay, author of the forthcoming book, Diet for a Hot Planet, The Climate Crisis at the End of Your Fork and What You Can Do About It. And I'm very pleased to welcome you all to the show.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Scott, most of the food-related policies in the city until now have focused on hunger, the availability of fresh produce, trans fats, calorie labeling. When did climate change become a city food policy issue?
Well, I think the purpose of this conference and some of these initiatives is to take the discussion of food policy in the city to another level. So for me, this is kind of like food 2.0. And it is this correlation between the climate, the planet, our own opportunity to have influence over our food supply. How do we categorize the various aspects of food production that relates to job creation and health? And how can we catalog that beyond New York City, but certainly closer to home?
Should I assume that the timing of this this conference was intended to coincide with the one in Copenhagen?
It certainly worked out. I think the world's attention is on Copenhagen, but I think what we're going to find at our conference, which really puts food as a component of climate change, which I think is a little different than what Copenhagen is doing, I think this is our opportunity in New York City to sort of seize the moment.
And do you think that they'll be discussing food, the delegates in Copenhagen?
My sense, and obviously I'm not in Copenhagen, I don't think that's going to be the agenda that comes out of there. Whereas I think our conference with 30 breakout sessions, these amazing speakers, 1,000 people who are coming to NYU tomorrow morning, this is going to be an opportunity to really drill down on these issues and come up with specific proposals for New York City government.
Anna, in your upcoming book, Diet for a Hot Planet, you write that people often don't make the connection between climate change and food. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's a complicated reason, and I think part of it has to do with the fact that when you sit down to dinner, it's not exactly that you kind of picture the smoke emanating from your food, right? But I think the deeper reason is that for so many of us, there's a fundamental disconnect between the food we eat and where it comes from, the food we eat and the environment, that those have been disconnected for many of us for a long, long time. And so talking about the food and climate change connection is about interlocking those stories once again, the story of where food comes from and the environment.
And you break that down for your readers. As you were researching it, did it turn out to be more pervasive than you'd previously thought?
Absolutely. And you know, the other reason why we haven't really been talking about it is because the story that we've been hearing in the media about climate change is certainly not focused on food. This study from Johns Hopkins University actually looked at what has been the reporting about climate change in the media. And when you look at those articles that have been published from 2005 to 2008, of the 4,000 articles about climate change, less than 2% even mention food and agriculture.
And the EPA only attributes 4.6% of greenhouse gases to it. You say that up to one-third of the total greenhouse gas emissions could be attributed to food.
Sure, and not to confuse all you listeners too much with too many of these facts and figures and statistics, but just so you understand, globally, when we're talking about the overall impact, direct and indirect, of the food system, we're looking at least about a third of all global greenhouse gas emissions, and that's going to be different per country. And also when you look at those U.S. emissions, we need to look at what's the emissions within the U.S., but also what the impact of U.S. consumers.
Now, the obvious ones are the fossil fuels that are used to bring the food to our area. But what about other greenhouse gases like methane and nitrous oxide? What role do they play in getting food to our table? I was shocked when I read about nitrous oxide. It's laughing gas. Dentists used
laughing
to
gas
give it to
and
you.
Not so funny. Right. So another reason why we haven't really been talking so much about food and agriculture is because we've been really focused on carbon dioxide emissions and not looking at the other key greenhouse gases as much. Now, that made sense because, of course, carbon dioxide is the largest component of global greenhouse gas emissions. But now that we know we really have such a crisis on our hand, we have to expand the conversation to all the key greenhouse gases, which include methane and nitrous oxide. When you do that, you realize that agriculture, primarily livestock production, is one of the key sources of methane and nitrous oxide.
What's the problem with nitrous oxide? I know about methane, yeah. But as I understand it, nitrous oxide is even worse.
So, yes. Yeah, so the IPCC estimates that over a 100-year time period, methane is about 23 times more powerful than carbon dioxide in terms of its global warming potential. Nitrous oxide, 296 times more powerful. And so even though right now nitrous oxide is about 8% of total emissions, it's going to be increasingly have an increasing impact on climate if we don't address it.
Marin, you've written about how the food industry affects what we know about the food we eat. Have you been seeing parallels about how industry spins messages about climate change?
Well, you just never hear anything about food and climate change. And the agribusiness would like everybody to think that the way we raise animals and the way we transport food have nothing whatsoever to do with it. I mean, what impresses me about what's going on with this conference is that it's part of what seems to me to be an enormous social movement around food these days. The conference sold out after 36 hours, and it's got 100, it has 1,000 seats. And people are just hammering to get into it because people are really concerned about this. But this is very grassroots from the bottom up and very tied to not only climate change issues but health issues, because the same diet that makes you healthy is also the one that would protect us against greenhouse gases.
But we've been seeing all sorts of health claims on the foods in the supermarkets.
Yes.
In some cases, companies have been forced to take those claims off. There's this whole greenwashing thing that's happening.
Absolutely. And if you want to, you know, the food industry's main problem is that we have an enormous surplus of food in this country. Nobody likes to talk about that. Because we have hungry people. It's just not distributed very well. And so the food industry's problem is to sell this enormous surplus of food. And the best way to do it is either by greenwashing or health washing or preferably both.
Mm-hmm. And I think what we're seeing from the lessons we can learn from Mary Nessel's work, we're seeing those same plays, the sort of pages from the playbook that the food industry employed to sell us on their so-called healthy foods, we're seeing in terms of environmental claims. So Fiji Water claiming that they're now carbon neutral. Well, maybe we shouldn't be buying bottled water shipped in from Fiji in the first place.
Well, but Scott, is this a city problem? This sounds to me like something the federal government should be concerned about, because we are really talking about Fiji water being imported into this country to every state.
Well, I think it's a combination of both. I mean, when you think about in the near future, by 2050, the 9 billion people who will inhabit this planet, the majority for the first time will live in urban centers. So if you look at the food chain or the food supply and how we're going to get food, not just but healthy food, into cities, that has to be a national transformation. So I do think you can't just rely on the federal government. There's so much that New York City can do, but elected officials have not been the leaders in this movement. The fact that 1,000 people want to hear what Anna LaPay or Marion Nestle have to say and all these conference speakers gives us the opportunity to craft state and city legislation around these issues.
Well, since so much of our food comes from outside the city, can we actually legislate that we have to be locavore?
First of all, I don't understand how we buy apples from Washington State when we can get them from Washington County. And what's the politics of that when you know that increased gas costs and transportation costs is not going to rule the day in the next decade or two? And I do think that we should have an urban farming agenda, an urban agriculture agenda in this city. And I don't think we're that far away from vertical farming and rooftop gardening. When you think about green buildings, 20 years ago, when I did a conference as a state legislator on green buildings, it was science fiction. And today, any building development party that comes to my office, the first thing we say is it silver LEED? Is it platinum LEED? we transform buildings, and why can't we do the same with our food supply?
My guests are Scott Stringer, Manhattan Borough President, Mary Nessel, Anna LaPay. We're talking about the New York City Food and Climate Summit that will be held tomorrow at New York University. I'm reminded that there was a time I was in Denver and somebody asked me why I was buying having Rocky Mountain trout for dinner because all they wanted to eat was beef. And I said, well, it's local. This was many years ago. And they said, well, you know, actually they catch it here. They send it to Seattle. It gets processed and then it shipped back to us. And I thought that has to be crazy. And we're talking about many years ago. Mm-hmm. I don't think that system has changed, has it?
People are trying to. I mean, one of the really exciting things about the kinds of things that are going to be talked about this conference is how you feed a city of 8 million or more, or a borough of however many people there are in Manhattan alone, with a food supply that pays more attention to environmental issues as well as health issues. And what impresses me about the whole idea is that climate change is not a completely separate issue from the kinds of things that I've always been concerned about. If you eat a healthier diet, you're going to be eating a diet that's better for the climate as well.
Many New Yorkers, Scott, don't have much of a choice about what they can eat because they live in the so-called food deserts, places with little access to fresh fruits and vegetables. What are some of the ways we can change that on a policy level?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, one of the issues that my office looked at not too long ago, we did a report very heavily covered by the New York Times, which showed that the city was subsidizing job creation by supporting McDonald's, KFC, Dunkin' Donuts, 14 gas stations in northern Manhattan, subsidizing those businesses, when now we say, wouldn't it be smart to subsidize green grocery stores, helping bodegas go green, creating incentivizing people to build supermarkets in our food desert, economically challenged communities. This is real work that we can accomplish, not in 5 or 10 years, but simply through the stroke of a pen. I do think it's time for City Hall to expand its reach by actually creating a commissioner for markets so that we have a real agency looking at economic viability of some of these initiatives, which is good for the city, but also creating health. And when you think about by 2018, there's a report that says that the United States is going to spend $334 billion on dealing with health issues related to obesity. And this is while we're discussing the whole national health care debate. The city, New York City, could lead by being very bold and forward-thinking. And that's what I hope comes out tomorrow.
Have you been talking to the mayor and members of the city council about this?
Absolutely.
And what's the response? Because I haven't seen any proposed legislation.
Well, I think part of what elected officials like to do is we like to set up task forces and commissions and things like that.
And write reports.
Tomorrow is going to be about trying to do in 5 hours what sometimes it takes politicians years to do. And we're hoping that through this effort, we will be able to go to the state legislature, go to the council, go to other town councils around the city, and give them legislative ideas and specific policy initiatives that can deal with these issues and have a debate.
My guests are Manhattan Borough President Scott Stringer, Mary Nessel, the Paulette Goddard Professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at NYU, and Anna LaPay, who was here some time back to talk about her book, Grub Now. She has a new book coming out early next year called Diet for a Hot Planet, The Climate Crisis at the End of Your Fork and What You Can Do About It. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Mary Nessel, the Paulette Goddard Professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at NYU. Anna LaPay, author of the forthcoming book, Diet for a Hot Planet, The Climate Crisis at the End of Your Fork and What You Can Do About It. And Manhattan Borough President Scott Stringer. We're talking about a conference being held at New York University tomorrow, put together by Scott Stringer and the organization Just Food to discuss food and climate. And one of the policy sessions focuses on strengthening the food shed. What's a food shed?
Well, Columbia University's Stone Barns initiative that we've been partnering with is to basically create a a food roadmap trying to document all the food outposts, production opportunities within a 100-mile radius of New York City or a 200-mile radius of New York City, the idea to bring production and resources closer to home. So the apple that comes from Washington State, you grow that closer to home. You figure out production capacity so that we can create entry-level jobs through that. The food shed has to, the study has to be funded. Senator Gillibrand is working with us. Congressman Steve Israel has actually put in an appropriation, the Long Island congressman. So we're building a movement around this food shed with the idea of being able to create a new economy closer to home in New York City.
Now, Stone Barns is in Westchester, but a lot of the food that we have gotten over the years in New York has come down from the Hudson River Valley. And in the old days, it would come down the Hudson River, and we would have these food markets along the river. And all of those things have been closed down through city policy.
Well, part of what
we're— Tribeca is now another kind of a place. It used to be where you went to get your butter and eggs.
Well, listen, one thing I will tell you is the skyline of this city and this borough change constantly, and things that were back then are not today. So the question now is, how do we recognize that part of our land use and zoning capacity has got to be about creating opportunities to open up these markets again?
I should have said Tribeca is where you go to get foie gras now. It used to be. Marion, one of the issues you're most often asked about is the safety of our food system. In producing food in a more environmentally conscious way, are we producing safer food as well?
I mean, nationally, it's a national scandal, and I cannot understand why Congress. Well, I can't understand why Congress is sitting on food safety legislation.
Despite these things that happen every so often,
these things that happen all the time, and the outbreaks are getting worse and worse and worse. And we know how to produce safe food. It's just that companies won't do it or can't do it, or need a little bit more encouragement to do it, and I wish that Congress would give it to them in a hurry. But one of the things that makes the food increasingly unsafe is the centralization of its distribution. And one advantage of doing food closer to home is not that that food is going to be perfectly safe. It's just that it's going to affect fewer people if there's something wrong with it. And it's easier to get a handle on it. So that's another advantage. I think it would have great safety implications.
And I would jump in to talk about another angle on the food safety issue, which is that as we face what we know we're going to face, which is more erratic weather, it's going to affect our food supply, that actually re-knitting those food sheds, this New York City food shed and these food sheds around the country, mm-hmm. is going to be a key part of another aspect of food safety, which is creating a resilient food system that is going to be able to continue to supply us the diversity of foods that we need to continue to feed ourselves and be healthy.
Yeah, I mean, we have winter here, so obviously.
But we also had a tomato blight this last summer,
yes.
locally, and that affected all the local tomatoes, didn't it? We had no choice but to bring them in from other parts of the country.
I don't know. We still had tomatoes even with the blight. But another thing that I wanted to point out is that everybody's growing their own food now. In little places, and you know, every little square inch of land, even at NYU, our fantastic gardeners started putting vegetables in planter boxes on the sidewalk. NYU doesn't have any land, it doesn't have much. So this also, I think, contributes to the resiliency of the system.
Anna, in your book, you're hopeful about turning the tide on climate change specifically through changing the food system. How would you propose that we do that?
Well, we're already starting to see it in the kinds of conversations that we'll all be having tomorrow, which is that we're starting to see as people wake up to the impact that our food system has on climate change, they're also waking up to the possibility that the food system holds in terms of actually mitigating climate change.
Well, you would have to change our agricultural system from industrial to a more climate-friendly approach. But whenever we talk about that, people start talking about the cost to the consumer. And I've had so many conversations on the show with you, Marion, and others, Alice Waters, where listeners then write in, oh, yeah, well, they can afford to buy all that stuff at the green market that costs 10 times as much as it does at my local.
Well, I need to jump in here because the reason that green market foods cost more than industrially produced food is because of the kind of food policy we have. Food policy is something that people make up. We could make up a different kind.
So we're subsidizing the industrial farmers.
Absolutely.
And we're not subsidizing.
Yeah, $20 billion a year to corn and soybeans, and the ingredients ingredients of industrialized processed foods, and very, very little to promoting more organic production, which would be better for the climate.
Exactly.
Could we produce it in the same quantities?
Well, you know, the studies on that are very mixed. And one of the interesting things to me about the studies is that I can predict what the studies say based on who did them. It's very, very difficult to get objective evidence on this, but most of the studies that I've seen going back a very long time say that organic production gives you about 85 to 90% of what you would get. And since we have this enormous surplus of food now anyway, that sounds okay to me. But I don't want to press that point too hard because, as I say, it's very, very difficult. The studies are hard to do to get real comparable data.
Anna?
And I would add, too, we also need to really remember anytime we talk about could we feed the world if we shift production into a more agroecological direction, to remember that currently the livestock sector is sucking up so much of the food that we're producing globally.
70% of the corn.
That's right. And 90% of the soy. So right now, this industrialized livestock production system is sucking up so much of our food that if we looked into a different system, we might fundamentally change that.
Yeah, think about taking some of that land in Iowa and producing something else, or even some of the land in upstate New York.
And you know what I think is fascinating about what's going to happen tomorrow is that these are the kind of discussions that never happen in urban centers or conferences at NYU. This is discussions that people have about Iowa or about the Midwest. And now, especially given the ability for us to revisit this issue, looking at it from a city perspective, I think people, when they learn about these issues, the livestock issues, the production issues, the job creation, hopefully elected officials and legislators will get involved in farm belt issues. Traditionally, that's been the job of those senators and members of Congress, and we sort of cede that to them. And I think that has to stop because we have to look at it as a national or international issue.
My guests are Manhattan Borough President Scott Stringer, Marion Nessel of NYU, Anna LaPay, whose latest book is Diet for a Hot Planet, The Climate Crisis at the End of Your Fork and What You Can Do About It. We're talking about the New York City Food and Climate Summit, which will be held tomorrow at New York University. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Following up on what you just said, Scott, you've been very active on the issue of improving the food system in New York City. You issued a report called Food in the Public Interest, How New York City's Food Policy Holds the Key to Hunger, Health, Jobs, and the Environment earlier this year. What got you interested in this as an issue? Is this something you've been interested in for a long time?
Well, I tell you what I got. The short version is when I got elected borough president, I realized I represented a borough that economically was very powerful, but yet when you looked at certain neighborhoods like East Harlem, you realized that children had amazing amounts of asthma, diabetes issues, health issues. So we created an initiative called Go Green East Harlem, where we brought the community together to sort of deal with some of the environmental crises that that neighborhood have, environmental racism decisions over many decades. And although I'm certainly not an author like Anna LaPay or Marion Nessel, we published the Go Green East Harlem Healthy Cookbook.
And I have to say, it's fantastic.
I don't have one.
Now, it was the best-selling cookbook of the United States. No, it wasn't. But it was really a treasure because it talked about people in the community and it gave a sense of pride and what green meant to poor economically challenged communities. But in having this discussion, we had Go Green Washington Heights, Go Green Lower East Side. It all came down to food and the food supply. So when we started dealing with this, we said, well, you know what, why don't we do a conference on the politics of food, because it was so political. And then here we are with this food conference with Just Foods.
Well, I mentioned earlier that we've lost a number of our markets. We lost the Fulton Street Fish Market as well. Do you think that was good for Manhattan?
You know, at that time period, that was about the mob and about fish. And
it wasn't about food.
There was never a discussion about food. But when you look at Hunts Point and you look at different production points or service points, that's what the food shed's about. How do we document and start thinking about how we do that kind of production? I think that this issue was not around. People didn't understand it. What really happened were the professors, the authors, the advocates were thinking about this 10 years ago. Politicians like me, quite frankly, we're new to this game. And one of the great things about the conference is the panelists and the speakers. these are the folks that have been talking about this. Now, what government's supposed to do or elected officials are supposed to do is we're going to take this energy and we have to turn it into concrete legislative proposals, policy initiatives. We have to go to mayors and governors and say, this is what we learned on Saturday. How much of this can we get done? And that's going to be a challenge for people like me. But we've also got to listen to folks out there who have thought about this for many, many, many years.
One of the things that you were talking about earlier, Marion, was more people growing food in this urban environment. But and there were times in the past when we actually had farms within cities, within the city limits. That all ended when property values just got too high. How do we make growing food in an urban environment more viable?
Well, the example that I love to give is the truck farm guys, the guys who made the movie King Corn. They are growing food on the back of a pickup truck in Red Hook. And it's you know, it's very funny, but it shows you how much food you can grow out of very, very small plots of land.
That's Kurt Ellis and Ian Chaney
and Kurt Ellis. You know, they're wonderful filmmakers, and they're making a movie of this, and it's on YouTube, and I'm in episode 2, I'm told. But it's really wonderful, and I'm so impressed by what the NYU gardener is doing, looking for places where he can grow vegetables on the NYU campus, which is, you just need a little imagination.
Well, in the past, there was concern that the pollution would affect the quality of the produce.
Well, that's a very real concern. And certainly for the farm that I have seen out in Red Hook, they had to have the soil tested and had to do some soil abatement. You can grow plants on it and then, you know, get rid of those plants and then do it the next year. But you do need to check that sort of thing.
And is this something that's being discussed in cities all around the country?
Absolutely. And it's really exciting to be here in New York City, where I do feel like we're trailblazing, but also to know that we're part of really a national movement. And Just Food, the co-sponsor of tomorrow's summit, has been really a leader in this movement of really reconnecting us to our food. So just since the mid-90s, when Just Food started, they've helped to connect people all across the city to community gardens, and that's happening all across the country, help connect us to our farmers markets, and the green markets here in New York City have done a great job with that as well. Truly is a national movement.
This concept of vertical farming is going to become part of this discussion in the near future.
Well, years ago, we had a conversation on the show about a building where you could do vertical farming. And I asked the person who was proposing it, I think the guy who invented the idea, when do you think this will happen? He said, soon. Well, it still hasn't happened.
But, you know, I'm not sure it's going to be a 20-story building, but I do think you're going to be able to – there are entrepreneurs out there already who are figuring out the cost of vertical farming as it relates to the amount of lettuce that you can produce and things like that. It's all going to happen within the next 10 years. And the city that grabs this economically and opens their eyes to this will be the city that creates an economy that's different.
Now, we have a link on our show page to the food charter. What's that?
That's basically going to be the Food Charter Bill of Rights, and it's 10 principles that we're asking people to sign on. It's an organizing tool. You know, part of what we've got to do is get people engaged in this. And you can have a conference and talk to people, but at the end of the day, we want them to believe in something. And part of what, if you think about what Mayor Bloomberg did when he became mayor and said, you know what, I want to bring the education department right next to City Hall because I want to make a statement. Well, we want the City Hall now to do what Michelle Obama did. Let's create the City Hall garden right outside. Because you know what that's going to do? In addition to giving the mayor and council members some healthy food, it's going to send a message that we are going to seize the green economy in this city. So tomorrow's proposal is about bringing a City Hall garden, food garden, right to the steps of City Hall.
We have very little time left, but on another important subject that we've been discussing a lot on WNYC, can you tell us a bit about your Kill the Drill initiative?
Well, that's something that we must win. This is about this new technology, frac drilling. Our office did a report showing that this kind of technology to drill for natural gas has caused streams to be polluted around the country, houses to blow up, and the fact now in the Marcellus Shale that we would even open up our watershed to a drill that could pollute our watershed and cost New York City $10 to $30 billion in filtration
costs. Because
this is
the source of most of our drinking water.
Yes, we are one of four municipalities in the country that drinks unfiltered water. That the fact that over 20 years this city has spent millions of dollars in taxpayer money buying up land in and around the watershed. We won't even let someone build a house there. Now you want Halliburton, the Cheney gang, to come in, start drilling, and explode our water system. To me, is the most outrageous thing the state would ever think about doing. Obviously, there's a lot of natural gas underground. There's a way to access that, but not through this last minute, you know, let's just go for it, whatever the consequences are. So you can come to the food conference, and you can also sign a petition to kill the drill. But if you can't get in, call, email us.
Well, you said that the conference is sold out.
36, it's just like a rock concert, you know, Nestle and LePay and Just Foods. These are the new rock stars. It's unbelievable. No one came to see me. I know that. But 1,000 people, it sold out in 36 hours.
And so for those of you who can't attend, we're actually going to be streaming a lot of the sessions online. But the cool thing about the conference, too, is we've heard today, it's not just about sitting around talking about big ideas. It's actually about trying to make real change happen. So out of the conference are going to be actual policies that people at the conference are going to get talk about, figure out, get excited about. And so if you want to connect to all of the people across the city who are going to be working to change the food system, you can find out about that through the Just Food website and I think through your office's website
Absolutely.
As well.
And we're going to be Twittering and blogging. We have some 40 bloggers coming tomorrow, so it's going to be out there.
I want to thank the three of you for being on our show today. Manhattan Borough President Scott Stringer, Anna LePay, whose forthcoming book is Diet for a Hot Planet, The Climate Crisis at the End of Your Fork and What You Can Do About It, and Marion Nestle, the Paulette Goddard Professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at NYU. It's been such a pleasure.
Great.
Thank you.